a picture of Adam Brown and myself. Adam's my collaborator, who's a postdoc at Princeton, and we were standing here in this landscape, and we were expecting to take a small step, but instead we found ourselves taking a giant leap. So the setup is the following. Let's assume you have a landscape of minima. So let's start with a field that's localized, say, in the leftmost minimum here. And classically, it's stable. It just sits there. But quantum mechanically, it's unstable. It can decay to any of these lower minima. And what does it do? Does it take a small step to a nearby minimum? Or does it take a giant leap and end up at a distant minimum? And that's the question we'd like to answer today.
Am I supposed to take that zero seriously, or is that...
Which zero?
So are you saying we're going to go from positive energy?
Oh, no. I mean, we will introduce gravity. We'll talk about the sitter and anti-sitter minima. This is just a toy picture. So the talk today will be in five parts. First, just by way of introduction, remind you guys about bubbles. I'll tell you that this simple potential here gives small steps. And then we'll move to the more interesting setup, which is flux compactifications, where you have extra dimensions and flux that wraps the extra dimension. And then the quantized vacua are indexed by the number of units of flux. And then we'll move to higher dimensional models, where you can have many different types of fluxes. And that'll introduce a configuration that we call monkey brains. I apologize for the name. You have to do, when you're working with Adam Brown, you have to make some allowances. I don't know if anyone met him. And then I'll talk about adding back reaction to the picture. So there you expect the size and shape of the extra dimensions to deform during the tunneling processes. And we'll talk about the extent to which that affects the story. And then finally, this is just like a neat aspect of it. But when you decay all of the flux, you end up with a bubble of nothing configuration. So I'll talk about that last. So first, let's assume we start localized in the leftmost minimum and want to decay. You can't decay the field uniformly everywhere, because that would involve the field picking up over the energy barrier, and that's an infinite increase in energy. Instead, what you can do is you can nucleate a bubble of true vacuum embedded in the false vacuum exterior. So the bubble gains energy by having an interior that's in true vacuum, but it costs some energy to have a domain wall that separates the two domains, and you can balance those terms against each other and create a zero energy configuration. So here, let's just, for simplicity, assume gravity's off. This is just quantum field theory.
In this simple picture, let's say in your false vacuum you have some additional perturbation or energy.
Yeah.
What happens during the time? It must go to the zero configuration, or can it tunnel to something more?
Well, so here I'm talking just about vacuum tunneling, but you might expect that if you have something in the false vacuum that it can help seed the nucleation of the bubble. But here in this talk, we'll just be interested in tunneling from vacuum states. So quantum mechanically, you'll nucleate a bubble configuration. And then because it's energetically favorable, the bubble will classically grow, the walls will accelerate outward, and they'll quickly reach the speed of light. The nucleation rate for these bubbles was worked out by Sidney Coleman. And in the thin wall regime, where there's a nice separation of domains between true and false vacua, the rate is given by this factor here. So it's the exponent of a factor that's called the tunneling exponent, or sometimes B. And it's given by sigma to the fourth over epsilon cubed. Sigma is the tension of the domain wall, and epsilon is the energy difference between the true and false vacua. So to calculate sigma, you just do a WKB integral through the barrier. And now we're ready to answer the question about small steps versus giant leaps in this model. Sigma just scales like n. So the more vacua you jump, the bigger sigma. Epsilon, also just the way I've drawn it, scales linearly with n. So sigma to the fourth over epsilon cubed scales linearly with n. And if you plot the tunneling exponent b, it's a straight line. And the most likely thing to decay to is the one with the smallest value of b. So the most likely bubble to form is the one that forms a small step. You expect to get all different types of bubbles, but the most bubbles you'll get is of small steps. Great. So let's move to a more interesting setup, and let's talk about flux landscapes. And here there's sort of two motivations that will inform the talk. The first is if you like models with extra dimensions, you have to compactify and you have to hold them fixed. And in doing that, you often introduce flux as one of the components that stabilizes the extra dimension. So if you like extra dimensions, you're sort of naturally led to flux landscapes. And you have to believe that our universe is one vacuum of a flux landscape. And then you would ask, how does our universe decay? What's the most likely decay route for our universe? And then a second motivation here is that the flux will shift the cosmological constant. So if you start with some bare cosmological constant, there's some energy density in flux, goes like 1/2 f squared. In standard E&M, that's 1/2 e squared plus v squared that we're used to. And it shifts up to larger values of the cosmological constant. So this, it goes by the name of the Busa-Polchinski model. There's this sort of explanation of the smallness of the cosmological constant that goes like this. You start off with positive value with a lot of flux, and then you slowly decay down, f squared relaxes, and you end in a universe that looks like ours with a small positive cosmological constant. So we can investigate the extent to which that story works by looking at tunneling and flux landscapes. And how does the tunneling proceed? Well, let's start with a simple picture. Let's start with 3 plus 1 dimensions, like we have here, and let's compactify two of them on a sphere. So this picture is supposed to represent that. You have one extended direction that goes along the page and two directions that are compactified on a sphere. And have flux wrap the sphere. So FAB will be proportional to the volume form on that two-sphere. And because we're in four dimensions, we can switch over to a picture of magnetic field lines. FAB has only got space-space components, so it corresponds to a magnetic field line that's perpendicular to the lines of F. So it's magnetic field that uniformly stretches down the extended direction. And it won't break Lorentz symmetry in the extended directions. Its only contribution will be 1/2 b squared to the energy. That's the only way you'll know this flux exists if you don't probe the extra dimensions. And how does this flux decay? Well, it decays by Schwinger pair production. You nucleate a monopole-antimonopole pair, so they will eat one line of magnetic field, so that between the monopole and the antimonopole, there's one fewer magnetic field line and there's less flux. And then because it's energetically favorable, the monopole and the antimonopole will accelerate outward towards infinity. Okay, so now we're ready to answer the question about higher dimensions. In higher dimensions, you have more extended dimensions, but still a sphere that sits at every point. FAB wraps the sphere. How do you discharge the flux? Well, you nucleate a magnetically charged brain. So the brain will sit at one point on the sphere, and it will form a bubble in the extended directions. And you should think of the bubble as the higher dimensional version of Schwinger pair production. So on the inside of the bubble, there's less flux, there's lower energy. Because it's energetically favored, the brain will accelerate outwards towards infinity. But why nucleate just one brain? You could instead nucleate a stack of brains, and then you drop the flux a lot more, and this will correspond to a giant leap. So we're also curious, what's the tension of the brain? So you want the brain you nucleate to be as light as possible, given the fact that it's charged. And you can express the constraint like this. If you take your brain or your monopole and you try to pull it apart, you want it not to fall apart. So when you separate, oh, we're losing a little bit of the screen here. There's another charge there, so that this one's getting pulled to or repelled by it. Gravitationally, it's attracted to its partner, and electromagnetically, it's repelled. And then if you want this not to be a repulsive force that rips the brain apart, you need M to at least be Q. And if you want to make the mass as light as possible, set M equal to Q. So we expect these brains to be extremal, their mass to equal their charge. What if there are two different types of charge? So let's assume they're just two different U1 fluxes. Then the brain can be charged Q1 under one and Q2 under the other, and the mass will add in quadrature, like the number of units of charge. So we expect the tension of our brain to add in quadrature. You specify the number of units of each charge it has, and its tension should be given by a BPS-type formula like this. So squiggly n is the number of types of charge. Okay, and we have these two formulas, and we have everything we need to go. F squared, the amount of energy density, is given by a sum over ni squared, where capital Ni is the occupation number you start with in the false vacuum. You discharge little ni, and the tension of the brain that discharges it is given by that. And you can just plug in sigma to the fourth over epsilon cubed, and we can answer what's the most likely decay route.
So what were the GIs?
The GIs are the charges that each U1 has. So
it's a fundamental unit.
Yeah.
Charge. And then the ni is the number.
The number of units, yeah. So just to have something concrete to discuss, let's discuss two different directions you can decay in a landscape. You can start from a point and decay in a monoflux direction. That's where you discharge more and more units of the same type of flux. And you could also discuss decaying in a multiflux direction. That's where you discharge a single unit of more and more different types of flux. In the first case, the tension scales linearly with the number of charges you drop. That's because the brains are extremal. Their tensions just add. You're just stacking extremal brains on top of each other. If you're doing it for multiflux decays, however, they're charged under different types of flux. So there's gravitational attraction, but no electromagnetic repulsion. That means they form gravitational bound states, and their tension is lower than n. Their tension scales like the square root of n. The change in F squared you can also compute by plugging in. In monoflux decays, the first flux line you discharge has more energy in it than the last flux line you discharge. And the reason is the flux lines repel. You're taking this capital N squared, and you're changing one of the N squareds to N minus little n squared. Whereas in the multiflux decay, that doesn't happen. Every flux line is charged under a different type of flux, so each one carries the same amount of energy. Delta F squared just scales like N. And you plug in. We plot B, which is sigma to the fourth over epsilon cubed, versus N, the number of flux lines dropped. And this is for a multiflux decay. We see that B is monotonically growing. In fact, it accelerates upward. So this is for monoflux decay. So this picture should roughly convince you that you never want to discharge more than a single unit of any type of flux. But if we draw this for a multiflux direction, it's actually monotonically falling. So the most likely decay in a landscape, subject to all of the assumptions we've made so far, is this point here. This is the point where you discharge a single unit of as many different fluxes as you possibly can. So what we've done is we've assumed the extra dimensions are just fixed and stabilized. There's no back reaction on the extra dimensions. We've assumed the brains are thin and well localized, and that the fluxes don't interact with one another. Subject to all of those constraints, the fastest decay is to decay a single unit of every type of flux. Yes. Yeah, B's the tunneling exponent. Yeah, so it's the difference in actions. And so that corresponds sort of to taking a giant leap. The expectation in the literature before this had been that the most likely decay was to discharge a single type of flux at once, but instead you discharge many and you change the energy by a lot more. Okay. Let's now add some complications. There's sort of two types of concerns you could have about this result. The first is that you don't expect there to be many different types of flux. What you expect is a higher dimensional model where you have an extra dimension with many different cycles, and you have one fundamental higher dimensional flux that can wrap the different cycles. And then when you go to your effective theory, they will look like different fluxes. And you could wonder, does the story still pertain there? And that's going to be the subject of the next unit. That'll introduce monkey brains. Yeah. Sure.
So it looks like it looks like it's asymptotic. The green line looks like it's asymptoting.
It goes like 1 over n, but then it gets cut off at the point where you have no more different types of flux to add. So it will monotonically fall all the way to the point where you discharge as many fluxes as possible.
And B1 was what?
It's just because I wanted to normalize this so we're not worried about the y-axis. I normalized it so that the point where you discharge one type of flux, one unit of one type of flux, has action 1.
And all of these things are long. All of these things are...
Yeah, these are all...
large bounce action.
You expect all of these bubbles to nucleate tremendously slowly. The question is just when you nucleate a bubble, what's the most likely bubble to nucleate?
So that complication you just described, that's precisely what Busso and Polchinski wanted, right?
Yeah, so to move this into a setup that's more natural for Busso and Polchinski. Yeah, so the real question is, all we used in that previous plot, I mean, so far, like, almost nothing has happened. We just took these two formulas that you expect in a landscape and plugged into them. But the question is, the first question we'd like to ask is, to what extent do these two formulas remain true in a higher dimensional model? So let's take a concrete model. Let's assume you have a Q-form flux and the extra dimension is a flat M torus. And so you want M to be bigger than Q. You want more sides of the torus than there are legs of the flux. And then the flux, so that it doesn't break macroscopic Lorentz invariance, will point its Q legs down the M directions of the torus. So it will pick Q directions to point its legs, and then there will be M minus Q directions it doesn't touch. And star F fills the extra dimension, extended directions, and points down the dual cycle to F. The number of different fluxes you induce is the number of ways the flux can point its legs down the torus, so it's M choose Q. And you can decompose the flux into basis Q cycles. So look at the component of the flux along each of the basis Q cycles of the M torus. And then when you take F squared, that's F wedge star F, you're always guaranteed, for the cross terms will all vanish. And the reason is that you always have one DWI1 wedge star DWI1 for any cross term. So 1 half F squared will just decompose into the sum over different fluxes. So you really do have genuinely different fluxes, and the first formula that F squared scales like the sum of N squared stays true. Let's talk about discharging flux now. So this is sort of the same picture we drew before. Here we have one extended direction, and now the extra dimension is a 2-torus, and the flux only has one leg, so it points down one direction of the 2-torus. Instead of, because it's now just a one-form, we don't have magnetic field lines anymore, we have magnetic field planes. The planes will fill the extended direction as before, but they also will stretch along the dual cycle. They'll also stretch along the perpendicular direction to the flux leg. So now if you want to discharge this type of flux, you have to nucleate a magnetically charged string. And the string will stretch along the dual cycle, and it will eat one of the magnetic field planes, so that on the inside there's one fewer line of flux. And that can be summarized here like this. When you go to higher dimensions, you expect the brain to form a bubble in the extended directions and to wrap the dual cycle to F. So let's talk about some concrete examples just to get some practice. This is the same example we were looking at before. This is a one-form F on a flat 2-torus. So there are 2-choose-1 different types of flux. If you want to discharge the type that points along the W1 direction, you stretch your brain along the W2 direction, and vice versa. What if you want to discharge a single unit of both types of flux? That's the decay that we decided was the most likely decay. Well, one thing you can do that's clear is you can stretch a brain along, I mean, you can have two different brains, one that goes along one cycle and one that goes along the other cycle. This will have tension 2 because the tension just goes like the length of this brain, and we have 2. But you can do better. Instead, if you stretch a single brain along the diagonal direction, it will accomplish this tunneling. It's an element of the same homology class. So it wraps the same cycle of the torus, and therefore it tunnels by the same number of flux units. This guy has lower tension. It only has tension root 2. So this formula that T should scale like the square root of N in that case stays true. And Adam and I will call these configurations that wrap cycles, the minimal area elements of their homology class, we'll refer to them as monkey brains, because they wrap the extra dimension like a monkey's prehensile tail. That's our story. So here is the monkey brain that drops 2 units of one type of flux and 1 unit of the other. Here it is... here it is projected onto one unit cell. And so the way to see that it drops 2 units is that it intercepts this line twice, and it intercepts a line that crosses this way once. And it should be clear at this point, we can do this for any number of the two types of flux units, and this formula will always stay true. In fact, it's just Pythagoras' theorem here.
You can get unitation back to actions. If there are fluxes,
yeah,
you're going to have these frame tensions. If there's a fluxes will contribute some energy on the frame. There's like some B or B squared or F squared that would change the tension in general.
That's right. So we're neglecting terms that look like that.
Because, I mean, you have flux there, obviously. And also, in general, it won't be flat space. So both the curvature and the presence of flux should affect your tension.
That's right. So we're assuming the flux sort of changes straight away from the inside to the outside from its symmetric configuration. So we're gonna not count modes that look like the variation of the flux in the extra dimension. Everything I'm saying is now just like the most basic story you can tell.
Have you guys thought a bit about including these corrections?
I'll talk in the second half about including the back reaction of the flux on the size of the extra dimension. Okay. But you can also think about things that vary along the extra dimension. And, I mean, you have to add complications one at a time. Let's look at one higher dimension now. Let's have the extra dimension be a 3 torus and have F be a 1-form flux. Now there are 3 choose 1, which is 3 different types of flux. In other words, the flux can point its leg down any of the 3 directions of the torus. You discharge a unit of the flux that points along the W2 direction by stretching a plane along the W1, W3 face of the torus, and so on. And again, we can see we can always form diagonal monkey brain configurations whose tensions add in quadrature. So this is the brain that blocks a single unit of 2 different types of flux. This is the brain configuration that drops a single unit of all 3 different types of flux. So the thing to see is that it blocks lines that go through any face. This is the monkey. I'm just showing you these pictures to confirm that we really can't do this. So this is the monkey brain configuration that drops 2 units of 1 type of flux and a single unit of the other 2. Now, I know that these pictures are a little hard to look at the first time, so I have one other visualization technique. Can we pass out some 3D glasses? Sorry, folks watching online. And you should put red on the right eye, if you can.
Red on the right eye?
Yes, to get this to work. And the thing to see is that it blocks this plane of the torus twice, this brain configuration, and the other 2 faces a single time. And I'm really sorry. I apologize, but I just have to. You understand. The point is up to this dimensionality, up to dimension 3, we can do this easily. Unfortunately, I'm now going to talk about the 4 torus, and we can't visualize it at all. So this is the point where things start to get complicated, is when even 3D glasses won't help. You guys should feel free to take the 3D glasses home. 4D
glasses?
Yeah. Next time. So let's talk about a flat 4 torus. I guess that should say T4. And a 2-form flux. There are now 4 choose 2 types of flux. That's because the 4 torus has 6 faces. And now we get our first complication. Let's say we try to discharge this type of flux, a DW1 wedge DW2 flux, for which you need a brain that stretches along the W3-W4 plane, and a DW3-DW4 flux, for which you need a brain that stretches along the W1-W2 plane. So those 2 brains, actually, they only intersect at a single point. And that means there's no configuration in which they can pull tauter. They can't reconnect and then pull into a diagonal configuration. So the best thing you can do is to just use these 2 brains. The tension here is equal to 2, and there's no monkey brain configuration that lowers the tension. And there are a handful of ways to see this. One way is that if you make these D brains, this configuration is known to be supersymmetric. So you expect no force between the brains, and their tensions should just add when you stack them. But
the brains themselves are monkey brains, aren't they?
Oh, we were calling the minimal area element of their homology class, we were calling them monkey brains. We should have just called them minimal brains. So I guess I would say the two-brain configuration is the monkey brain configuration.
But I mean those two brains are both sort of diagonal type brains themselves, right?
Yes. So they're both flat brains. So the way, no longer true. The way to think about this that we found most helpful is the following. Let's take, this is Maxwell's equation when it's sourced by a magnetic brain. So J is the magnetic charge on the brain. And let's integrate in a Gaussian pillbox across the brain. So when you do that, you come up with a formula that looks like this. The change in flux between the inside and the outside of the bubble is given by this. Where so G is the charge of the brain, and Y, the Ys are one forms that span the brain. So they're introduced just in J. It's the volume form on the brain. And the problem is that you, instead of reading this as the amount of flux dropped by a brain, we can read this as a condition on the flux to be droppable by a flat brain. So this type of flux here can't be written as a bunch of one forms wedged together. This is the most compact way you can write it. And this condition that a flux is writable as a bunch of one-forms wedged together is known as decomposability. And when the flux you'd like to drop is decomposable, then there is a diagonal brain that drops the right amount of flux, and its tension is just given by the square root of n. Because this is the volume form on the brain, you just have Pythagoras' theorem. When your flux is not decomposable, you know you have to do worse than the square root of n. The tension has to be bigger than the square root of n. But at the same time, the tension can be smaller than n. You can do better than just stacking up flat brains to do this. And here's the way to see it. Let's try to drop a single type of all six fluxes in this case. So we want one brain for each face of the four torus. So this configuration would have tension 6, but you can do better. There's a lower tension configuration. One thing that's clear is you can kind of cluster the brains in groups. The first three brains then can form their own monkey brain. And the way to see that is they don't overlap in the W4 direction at all. So you know you can form this diagonal configuration I showed before. And the last three brains all overlap in the W4 direction. So just ignore the W4 direction, and then there are black strings on the remaining three torus. And there again, you can stretch a black string across the diagonal of the three torus. So we know we can get the tension down from 6 to twice root 3. But it can actually get even better. So those two brains that we just described still intersect along a line. So you can still allow them to reconnect to each other, and they will pull into a tauter configuration. But you know the tauter configuration can't be flat. So it turns out the minimal area element here is actually a curved brain that wraps the torus, which is quite strange coming from just a flat torus. But we know that its tension is smaller than n, but bigger than the square root of n. So there will still be an enhancement to discharging many different types of flux. But exactly how big the enhancement is becomes a very complicated question. And this introduces a couple really strange features. First, it breaks the rotation symmetry of the landscape. So like if you're starting from one point in the landscape and you want to decay in some number of types of flux, it depends which types of flux. Like this direction will be different from a direction that's 90 degrees away. And the way to see that is that this type of flux is decomposable. So here you pick two different types of flux, and you can write it as dw1 plus dw3 wedge dw2. So it is decomposable, and that means it discharges fast. But here, if you pick two different types of flux, it's not decomposable, and then it'll discharge slower. So you shouldn't just think about the landscape as a rectilinear grid of fluxes. There are directions in the landscape that are faster and directions that are slower. And then, even bizarrer, it breaks the reflection symmetry of the landscape. So a point with some list of occupation numbers, if you take one of the occupation numbers, capital N, and change it to minus capital N, so you reflect across one of the planes, one of the axes of the landscape, then the decay rate out of that state can be different from the decay rate out of this state. And the way to see that is that if you start at some point and you want to discharge these four types of flux at once, well, these four are decomposable. It's dW1 plus dW2 wedge dW3 plus dW4. But if you change one of these types of flux that you'd like to discharge from a plus sign to a minus sign, so in other words, if you start with minus types of flux instead of plus types of flux, then this configuration isn't decomposable. And that means it will discharge slower. So I guess I can sum up this section of the talk by saying that when you look at these higher dimensional models, the phenomenology becomes much richer. And there are a lot of complications that need to be explored here. So that's going to sort of end what I'd like to say about monkey brains. So if there are any questions about that section, now's the time.
Do you know how to formulate the problem of calculating the tension of the curved brains?
Yeah, so it's actually, I mean, we looked at some math papers, and it seems like it's still an open question in higher dimensional, even in higher dimensional tori, but especially in more complicated manifolds. So it's related to the plateau problem of finding like stable configurations of soap films. There are a couple things you can do. When your internal manifold is Kähler, some cycles are what's called calibrated, and there you can find a minimal area element. But I think unless you have complex manifolds, it's hard to say anything in general.
So I have a question.
Yeah.
So I mean, if I have like a typical landscape vacuum, and look at the various domain walls which separate me from my neighbors, mm-hmm. and typically they won't be BPS if I'm in some non-supersymmetric vacuum.
Right.
So I'm just wondering how. I mean, at the beginning you sort of mentioned maybe it was just for simplicity that you have this BPS condition on your domain walls. I'm wondering how big a role that actually played in your. Is it just
classification,
or is it actually key in making?
I think that's exactly what's happening here on the torus. So when you have when you just have configurations where it sums in quadrature, that's when the domain wall between the two vacua is BPS. If everything I've said so far was without supersymmetry, but if you imagine supersymmetrizing,
right.
But then these configurations where the brain needs to be curved, those correspond to cases where supersymmetry is broken.
Yeah, no, I just mean that you have this relation like M is equal to Q.
Right.
I was wondering how important that assumption is in drawing conclusions about whether multiflux decays are more important, are quicker than monoflux decays or not.
The fact that M scales like the square root of the number of different types of flux discharged, that was the important enhancement. That's the reason different fluxes, that's half of the reason different fluxes like to discharge together.
But the coefficient wasn't important. It was just a linear relation. Right?
That's right.
So it could have been twice whatever the BPS bound is, as long as it was some kind of linear relation. Mm-hmm. It would have still...
Well, you could imagine maybe different linear relations for each cube.
Either way, just from general arguments, you expect different types of fluxes to enjoy discharging together. And the reason is the brains that discharge them will have gravitational attraction necessarily and no electromagnetic repulsion or weaker electromagnetic mm-hmm. propulsion than expected. So you do expect them to bind, and you expect the tension to be smaller than M. I think the question of... So it goes all the way down to square root of n when you're in these special configurations, but I think otherwise you do expect some enhancement. It's just not clear how much.
I mean, n to the 3/4 is sort of the critical.
Yeah,
scaling, right?
That's assuming that epsilon is scaling linearly, which isn't necessarily true.
Okay.
But N to the 3/4 is sort of the nice one to think about if you think about epsilon scaling linearly.
Sorry, I mean, epsilon scales nonlinearly because of these 1 over n, 1 over big n,
epsilon is, first of all, if you freeze the size of the extra dimension, epsilon goes like n squared, right? I mean, so you start with some capital N squared, and then capital N changes to capital N minus little n.
Right.
So epsilon scales like n minus n squared minus n squared. So it's already not linear. But when you add, so this is what I'll talk about now. When you let the size of the extra dimension vary, it's actually enhanced to discharge many units of flux. So
can I ask?
Yeah.
I think you tried to answer this before, and I guess I just didn't quite get it. The example you looked at, the torus, was very, very symmetric, that geometry.
Yes.
So how much do the results rely on that symmetry? And if I...
Yeah.
Something that, a collabial, I don't expect that there are symmetries.
That's right. So when you look at, so I think you get these enhancements when cycles are close to each other. And that's sort of the general lesson. If you have a collabial with a cycle over here and a cycle over here, you probably won't expect the ideal brain configuration to wrap this cycle and then to go all the way around and wrap this cycle. But when the cycles are close, you sort of do expect the brain to wrap both cycles. And then the question of calculating exactly its tension depends on finding minimal area element. So that's a hard question. But I think the general lesson here is if a brain is wrapping one cycle, you sort of expect it to go and wrap its neighbor cycle too. Okay. So now let's try to tackle the question of back reaction, because this whole time we've just held the extra dimension fixed, and that's not realistic. So we're going to now pick a specific model where the flux is an ingredient in the compactification, and the specific model is called the 60 Einstein-Maxwell theory, and we chose this model because it's the simplest one I'm aware of that has de Sitter minima. So what you'll do is we start with 6 dimensions, that's 5 plus 1, and compactify 2 of them down on a sphere so that you end up with 3 plus 1 extended directions. And then the size of the sphere will be stabilized by 3 ingredients in the potential. First, the spatial curvature of the sphere itself. Then there will be flux, of course. The flux will wrap the 2 sphere. And we'll have a 6D positive cosmological constant. The effect of that will be to lift some of the minima so that you end up with the Sitter solutions. If you don't like the fact that there is a positive cosmological constant in the bulk theory, you could just imagine that it's some other term in the potential that's lifting it. That is not important to the story. So here's the action that we're interested in. There's the Einstein piece, the Maxwell piece, and the positive cosmological constant. And parameterize the metric like this. This is the 2-sphere, and its size is parameterized by a field psi called the radion. So when psi gets big, the sphere gets big. And then when you do this, you also have to scale out by e to the minus psi the 4-dimensional metric. So just factor out a factor of e to the minus psi. And the reason you do that is when you express the metric like this and plug into R and integrate out the sphere, the effective theory ends up in Einstein frame. Then also we'll have F. We'll have many different types of fluxes, each one wrapping the sphere, so each one proportional to the volume form on the sphere. And we crunch down and we get, in the effective theory, a single scalar field, the radion psi, and it lives in a potential that looks like this. There are 3 terms. The flux term is short range and repulsive, so it operates at the smallest values of psi, and it pushes psi out towards larger values. So it will buttress the sphere against collapse. The curvature term acts at medium range, and it's attractive. It makes the sphere want to shrink. And at long range, the cosmological constant term is repulsive as well. The flux term makes a variable contribution to the potential. It depends on the number of units of flux. And when you add the curvature term, you end up forming minima, all ADS, but stabilized values where psi can sip. And then the cosmological constant term lifts some of them so that some of the minima are de Sitter. There's one Minkowski minimum, and the rest are anti-de Sitter. As all of the flux is released, the potential becomes unstable towards rolling to psi goes to minus infinity. And that solution will correspond to the bubble of nothing. So what we have is a landscape of discrete vacua indexed by the number of units of flux. And in each vacuum, psi will sit along on a different potential at the minimum. Oh, so you can, I mean, there will be a discrete number of solutions that look like this, and the number of solutions is set by a parameter in the theory. So it's set by the magnetic charge of the brain. It's set by how much flux you discharge when you nucleate one brain. So you can make a large landscape just by having you discharge very little flux, and then there'll be all sorts of lines that look, all sorts of potentials that look like this. Or if you discharge more flux, you can have fewer. So that's tunable.
Tuning.
Yes.
And you're saying that's where we live.
Yeah, so we would expect ourselves to live at small positive cosmic
number. Right. But I mean, there's no reason that one of them, that one of them was at zero and so that were.
One of them being at zero is tuning. But you can make a whole bunch of them have small positive cosmological constant without tuning,
right,
just by having a large degeneracy factor.
Sure.
Are you going to tell us how, you're going to talk about a certain kind of decay, but it seems you can also...
I'm going to talk about every type of decay. So when you have less flux, you're in an ADS vacuum and more flux, you're in an ADS vacuum. Okay, so let's assume we start localized here in this minimum at small positive cosmological constant. How do you transition? Well, one thing you can do, if that's absolutely right, is you can decompactify. You can form a bubble whose interior is on the other side of the potential barrier. And then it will roll off towards psi goes to plus infinity. The extra dimension will get bigger and bigger, and you'll end up in six-dimensional de Sitter. Another thing you can do is discharge a little flux. And when you discharge a little flux, the shape of the potential changes, and psi will relax down to its new value of the minimum. Or you can discharge a whole lot of flux. And if you discharge a whole lot of flux, the potential changes a lot. One other thing you can do is you can discharge absolutely every unit of flux. And if you do that, the potential is unstable, and psi rolls all the way off to minus infinity. And it will hit minus infinity in finite time. So that will correspond to the extra dimension just completely vanishing. And this will look like a bubble of nothing. There's also these solutions where you discharge a little flux and decompactify. So when you discharge a little flux, you lower the potential barrier. So maybe you decompactify faster. So Adam and I investigated this question, and it turns out these solutions you can prove are always subdominant to just regular decompactification. So there's never a benefit to simultaneously nucleating a brain. So I won't talk about these anymore in this talk, but if people have questions about this, I do have answers. Yeah.
When you're discharging, you're producing some pairs of brains.
Yeah, so the discharging happens the same as before. You still need to nucleate a bubble of brain.
Right.
It's just now we also have a psi field.
Yeah. So I would have thought that tension, I mean, has that been taken into account in this picture?
What?
The back reaction of the tension of the brain server?
Yes,
my expectations wouldn't change much because I was like, the energy doesn't seem to be basically conserved, so I'm a little confused about this picture.
I'm not sure what your question is. The brains do back react on a psi field, and that is included in what I'm saying.
Okay.
But I didn't understand the second half. Let me keep going, and then please ask again. So there's sort of three things we expect back reaction to do. First is that you expect the brain to back react on psi. In fact, you'll expect the radion field to spike in the vicinity of a brain. Brains will tend to swell the extra dimensions in their vicinity. And the way to see this is that the brain tension just has a terminant that looks like this. It's the tension times the volume of the brain. But the effective 4D metric is this G, and it's scaled out by a factor of e to the minus psi. So when you look at the induced metric on the brain, you can pull out this factor of e to the minus psi, c to the minus 3 halves psi. And this means the brain tension couples to the psi field. So when you add a brain, the extra dimension tends to stretch out in the vicinity of the brain. And this will have the effect of inducing an attractive force between brains. So when you have two brains, so sort of the total effective tension of a brain is given by three terms. First, the psi field has to stretch out to its value at the brain. And then there's the tension of the brain. And then the psi field relaxes back. But once you've gone to all the trouble of stretching the extra dimension, you may as well stick in a second brain while you're at it. And the effective tension, adding all three terms, will be smaller than twice the effective tension for a single brain. So this allows brains to form bound states that lower their tension. And that helps giant leaps in the sense that you will now, before there was no reason to want to discharge more than a single unit of a type of flux, but now this gives a reason. Here's a second reason. That you might like to discharge more types of flux at once. It's that the radion will readjust after the energy is dropped. So if you sit up here in this false vacuum and you discharge flux, this is sort of the 1/2 f squared that you anticipated getting at fixed value of the radion. But then the psi field will relax down to its new value of the minimum. When you lower the flux, you feel the curvature term more because the extra dimension will stabilize at smaller values of psi. And you sort of knew this was going to have to happen because when you discharge all of the flux, you don't just get f squared amount of energy. Instead, you get infinite amount of energy because you roll all the way to minus infinity. So there's extra energy than anticipated from nucleating more brains. But the other thing we'll have in this picture now with back reaction is thick walls. So the psi field won't necessarily get all the way to its minimum. After the brain sits there, the psi field will roll towards the true minimum, but it won't necessarily hit it. So you're going to lose some energy, and you're going to have extra energy in the walls. So you want to take all of these things together and now see what happens. You still get giant leaps. So what we did was we numerically calculated the instanton profiles here. And this is a sample instanton profile that we have where you discharge, I think it's 85% of the flux. So I kind of spread this out so it looks like Batman. But let me explain what this is. This is the size of the extra dimension on the y-axis. So it's e to the psi on the y-axis. And on the x-axis is the area radius of the bubble. So it's the proper distance out from the center of the bubble. And I drew out the mirror copies because you should imagine spinning around the x-axis. And if you spin around the x-axis, you'll form sort of the two-sphere that sits at every point. And you should also imagine spinning around the y-axis. And if you do that, you'll form the bubble. So when you spin around the x-axis, you should get an S2. And spin around this axis, you should imagine getting an S4. And the red dot is the brain. And so you see the radion is discontinuous at the point where the brain sits. That's sort of the spike in the radion field. But then the radion also has to interpolate between its false vacuum value and its true vacuum value. And in doing that, it kind of flattens out the spike. So you don't end up, when you look at the whole thick wall picture, with much of a spike in the radion field. And we can now... Because we can compute these, we can plot B as a function of N for any model you're interested in. And let's look at two extreme examples just to test sort of.
I'm just confused about something.
Yeah.
Isn't the brain itself supposed to be the instanton profile?
Well, so there are now two ingredients. There's a brain that discharges the flux, and there's the psi field. And we're going to look at thick-walled effects in the psi field. So, I went the wrong way. The whole thing taken together is what I'm calling the instanton. The brain still forms a bubble, but then there's some effect on the radion field that spreads out away from the brain.
Can I
assessing it. So going back to this picture where the brain sort of puffs up that extra dimension in its vicinity, is it, I mean, I know if I have a larger, if I make an dimension large, it sort of bumps up and flying. And so if I put something in that region, it sort of couples weaker to gravity.
So
I wonder if that's sort of the effect that makes it, you can add more things in that region without it costing too much energy.
Yeah, that's basically it. When the extra dimension swells, the brain's effective tension is decreased.
It's coupling your gravity is weaker.
Yeah. I think that's an okay way to say it. But you simultaneously have to pay the cost of moving the radion away from its minimum. Okay, so let's look at two extreme examples, just to test everything we've said so far in thick-walled regimes. So the first example, let's call a monoflux landscape. That's a landscape with just a single type of flux and many units of it. That means every time you discharge flux, it's a monoflux decay. And the second type of landscape is a multiflux landscape. That's the other opposite. So let's ignore monkey brain issues and just take there to be many different types of flux. Let's have them be many distinct types of flux, but only a single unit of any type of flux. That means wherever you are, no matter how you decay, you're forced to decay in multiflux decays. So this is a plot of B, the tunneling exponent, as a function of the number of units of flux dropped. In a monoflux landscape. So despite the arguments I gave, I guess I don't want to judge how convincing they were, that you might like to discharge many types of flux at once, thick-walled effects just don't allow for it. So in a monoflux landscape, still the most likely thing to decay is to discharge as many as just a single unit of flux. So here you can scale out by the number of vacua in the landscape. So on the x-axis, it's the fraction of the landscape jumped. And if you jump all the way to 1, you discharge all the flux, and you get a bubble of nothing. And here the tunneling action is always scaled out by this factor of m to the fourth, where m is the 4d Planck mass divided by the 6d Planck mass. So in models that you hope might solve the hierarchy problem, where the volume of the extra dimension is big, these values on the y-axis are huge. They're like 10 to the 19 or so. So the bubbles nucleate with rate e to the minus 10 to the 19, so bubble nucleation is still incredibly slow. You also expect discrete vacua to be placed along this curve with a spacing set by g. G kind of measures the size of the landscape, but is tunable in the model. So just you'll go to the first dot that lies along the curve will be the most likely decay.
Here, the assumption of this BPS condition that governs the tension is quite important.
Yes.
Because you could still then get an opposite behavior. Right, because the tension controls how much the extra dimensions swell.
That's right.
So you have a different relation. The effect would be different if you had, here, say, larger or smaller.
Yeah, here the assumption is that the tension scales like m. That's right. And so this is also the tunneling rate given from a Minkowski vacuum. You can make the same plots given from de Sitter vacua and ADS vacua. And there you have these Coleman-DeLucia effects. But the plot looks almost the same no matter where you start in the landscape. So unless you go to the very top of the landscape where the most likely decay is decompactification, otherwise the most likely decay is discharge a single unit. But now we can talk about the other extreme, the multiflux landscape. And this is the plot given from a Minkowski vacuum. And giant leaps win, and they win to an enormous extent. So the whole first half of the landscape is gravitationally blocked. Those instantons just don't exist. There's no way to tunnel to the near neighbors. This was an effect explained by Coleman and DeLucia. The way to think about it is the interior of the bubble is ADS, so it's negatively curved. So its volume to surface area ratio doesn't scale like a bubble in flat space. Instead, most of the volume sits near the surface area. I mean, near the surface. And what you want to form a bubble is to have zero energy. So you want the tension of the domain wall to balance the energy gained by having an interior. But you just have less volume on the interior because it's ADS. And so it turns out you just can't form zero energy bubbles for the whole first half of the landscape. And then afterwards, B is monotonically decreasing and pretty quickly all the way down to the value 9 at the end of the landscape. So the most likely decay in a landscape that looks like this is the bubble of nothing. You can make the same plot from an anti-de Sitter starting point, and there even more of the first part of the landscape is blocked. Or you can make the plot from a de Sitter landscape, so from a de Sitter starting point. So here, if you start with de Sitter, the plot of B looks like this. And you should again imagine discrete dots to be placed along the curve. So if you're in a very big landscape, the first dot will be at small values of B, and then that will be the preferred decay route. But otherwise, if you're in a smaller landscape, the first dot will be higher than this value here at the end. And then the fastest decay will be to form a bubble of nothing. So I can sort of sum up qualitatively what you anticipate in models that look like this. It's that, so this squiggle is just supposed to like represent the fact that you have a discretium of vacua. And if you start very near the top, the fastest decay is to decompactify. Otherwise, you expect to take a few small steps and to lower the cosmological constant a little bit. And then at some point, well before the habitable zone, which is here, you anticipate you'll take a giant leap and end up all the way at the bottom of the landscape, which is a bubble of nothing. And so if you do like the Busso-Polchinski model as an explanation of the smallness of the cosmological constant, this feels like a problem. To me, I mean, anthropics are a pretty robust argument, so it's hard to say anything concrete. But if you expect the universe to sit here, then its parent vacuum, which is any of the vacua up this chain, this is an exponentially subdominant decay that landed here. We expect our parent vacuum far preferentially to have nucleated a different type of universe. So it's definitely a needle in your side if you like that type of argument.
Sorry, why can't we be at the end of that
V? So all of these vacua that sit at negative values of V are ADS.
It's actually negative.
Yeah. And the very end of the leap is, I'll tell you in a second, the giantest leap of all is a bubble of nothing. And let's see how that works. So this is the same picture I showed before. This is the instanton that tunnels 85% of the way down the landscape. This is the one that tunnels 90% of the way down the landscape. The size of the extra dimension is even smaller on the inside. This is 95%, and that's 100% of the way down the landscape. When you go all the way down to the bottom, you still have a smooth instanton, but the instanton looks very different. So before you had smoothness, smoothness corresponded to the fact that kind of this intersection with the axis of symmetry was a right angle. But here you have an instanton where the size of the extra dimension crashes down to zero, and it's smooth because this intersection here is a right angle. This sort of looks like a straight up and down line, but it's not. It actually has a little curvature. It's just hard to show in a picture. So you should compare this solution we've constructed to the bubble of nothing solution that you know, which was described by Witten in 1981. So Witten's description was of a 5D unstabilized bubble of nothing. He started with one extra dimension that was compactified on a circle. And there you have a massless radion, and just nothing stabilized the radion. And there's an instanton that corresponds to a bubble of nothing where the size of the extra dimension smoothly pinches off to zero. And then inside the bubble, there's just absolutely nothing. There's no space or time. Our solution, a brain discharges the flux, and then there's only the curvature term in the potential. And the curvature term in the potential drives the radion to zero much faster than before. So the extra dimension crashes down to zero, and again, there's nothing on the inside. So we know as you discharge flux, one thing is clear, which is that the extra dimensions will shrink to zero size. But you also might wonder about the three volume of a slice through the bubble. So like, let's let's make this question personal. Let's say you left a pancake that was sitting here at a fixed point in the extra dimension, and it's just sitting inside the bubble, and then we take this limit. And you were really excited about eating this pancake. The question is, what happens to the pancake in the limit where the flux goes to zero? There's a second thing that's happening besides the extra dimension getting small. It's that the value of V, the energy density inside the bubble, is going to minus infinity. So that means the interior of the bubble is negatively curved. And remember, negative curvature has this funny property that most of the volume sits near the surface. It sits within one ADS curvature length of the surface. So when the bubble is big enough, so for bubbles that are bigger than the ADS curvature scale, I wrote this in terms of circles, their volume is proportional to the surface area times L curve. Instead of their volume going like R to the fourth, their volume goes like R cubed times L curve. And as we take the limit where the size of the extra dimension vanishes, V also goes all the way to minus infinity. So L curve goes to zero. And that means all of the volume that used to be inside the bubble gets pushed out, and all of the volume sits here. So this is a configuration that has surface area. It's a bubble, but it has no volume on the inside. It's a bubble of nothing.
So the extra dimensions go to zero size, but it's always.
Yeah. So that's a thing you might worry about, but we can explicitly construct the metric, and the metric is everywhere smooth. Now, another thing that happens that I should have said is, so for these, usually when you form ADS bubbles in Coleman de Lucia, you end up not at exactly the minimum. You end up a little bit off from the minimum, which means there are small perturbations around ADS. And small perturbations tend to crunch in ADS and form a singularity. But there's one other thing that has to happen for this to really be a bubble of nothing, and it does. You can watch it happen. It's the point where you pop out on the minimum. In the potential gets closer and closer to the minimum as you take this limit. And in the limit, you end up popping out right at the minimum. So I really do think you're forming a bubble of nothing here. This is just a summary to remind you of everything that happened. Let me just end with this thought here in blue, that if you live in a multiflux landscape, so if you believe in extra dimensions, you sort of are naturally led to think about us living in a multiflux landscape, then there are two conclusions I think you should draw. The first is that our parent vacuum was much more likely to decay to a different vacuum. So our universe is exponentially subdominant in the landscape. And the second is that when our universe decays, it will likely be to a bubble of nothing. And that's going to suck. Thanks.
Can you make any sort of estimates of the lifetime of our universe under the circumstances?
Well, so they depend on the model you have in mind. So, I did pick an explicit model here, but it's a very toy model. Like the idea was to kind of draw general conclusions. But the lifetime of the model, so lifetime of the universe, B scaled like m to the fourth. So if you want to tune the universe to be long-lived, you want the volume of the extra dimension to be big.
So it would be interesting to know in your model how big does it have to be for something with our cosmological constants to survive as long as 10 billion years.
Yeah.
Check that.
We can do that right now. It shouldn't be hard. Let's look at this plot. The B's tend to be order 1. It's B over M to the 4 tends to be order 1 in this model. I think people say you want B to be about 100 if you wanted to live as long as the universe has. I think that's the number people say. So you want m to be about the square root of 10. So that's r Planck mass divided by the fundamental Planck mass.
Well, that's not very hard then.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and models that solve the hierarchy problem need volumes that are big enough that the universe is very, very long-lived.
And can you also say something about, given a landscape with, say, lots and lots of flux directions so that you could make cosmological constant as small as observed, then you could also say something about the probability of landing in the right one or close to the right one. Right? So you know the branching ratios to the various final states, and you know how many initial states you got.
So. Yeah, so questions like that tend to be sensitive to the measure problem. Like you could just count numbers of bubbles, but do you weight by the volume on the inside of the bubble? So you're sensitive to questions like that. But I think you can think about so the expectation sort of is that you will jump over many vacua each time you decay. And that means that there will sort of just be a couple bubbles that are strongly preferred to decay into. Those are the ones that have the same number of units of every type of flux. So you like to decay to those ones, and then those ones like to decay to each other. So those ones will. So it means that there are highways in the landscape. There are very preferred decay channels. And it kind of collapses down this whole higher dimensional landscape with the large degeneracy of vacua kind of down to just a couple directions. And then it's very unlikely that our small cosmological constant lies in this decay path. Because now you don't, I mean, the reason you expected our universe to be in the landscape is that you need more than 10 to the 137 vacua. But, I mean, instead of looking at every decay direction, you're kind of just looking at the diagonal directions. So you're going back down to a one-dimensional landscape. I think you know that our universe is going to be subdominant. It's going to be off the highway. And then the question of how you get to there is, I think, dependent on exactly the model. Yeah, I'd say when you try to apply this result straight to Busa-Polchinski, you need to pick a measure. There were these studies looking at like the staggering problem. There were people who studied this in the past, decays in Busa-Polchinski, and they all assumed you decay by just one unit of flux at a time, and they all drew different conclusions. But I guess they all should go back and assume the correct thing, which is that you decay many types of flux at once. And see how their conclusions change.
But maybe a simpler question. We know where we are. Mm-hmm. We can ask where we most likely came from. So the conclusion you're telling me is that we most likely came from a vacuum way up the chain.
Yes.
And not something that's adjacent in flux space.
Yes.
Right.
But if we're off the highway, I thought that conclusion was not true anymore.
Yeah,
we're here. So,
no, but that doesn't mean that we're in one of these flux vacua where you just have one unit of each.
That's true. I would say, it's probably a complicated question because you do think we're off the highway. So at the point,
but still, I mean, you're telling us that it is more likely in general to nucleate a stack.
But he also told us that it's very unlikely that our vacuum, the small cosmological constant, is one of those in the chain of transitions.
And it says we're here. I just want to know where we're
coming. I mean, wouldn't you say that we did come from one of the adjacent ones and that came from that was too small?
So it tends to be, if you have if you freeze the size of the extra dimension and just go back to the thin wall case, then you can talk concretely about this. And it tends to be that decay, states that are off the diagonal like to decay toward the diagonal. So they like to line up their occupation numbers so they're all roughly the same. And then states that are on the diagonal decay down the diagonal. So those are the ones that skip over many different types of vacuum. And then there are some twists in the story. Like it looks like as you approach the diagonal, you kind of round the corner a little bit. Like at some point you start discharging a couple types of flux at once. As long as you believe that our universe is far away from any of that, I think I don't know. I guess it's not clear to me exactly where we came from.
So when you nucleate a bubble of nothing, this is a bubble that expands from the standpoint of our 4D space, but inside there's a zero body.
Right. And yes. You should think about it as having very negative curvature on the inside.
So if you think about the reverse process where our space time where a bubble hit the reverse. So can I think about the inverse thing where the bubble of nothing collapsed in from infinity and we're left with a space time there that we lived in?
So I think you can take this instanton that looks like. So if you start from one of these solutions where de Sitter space decays to a bubble of nothing, you have an instanton that looks like nothing on one side and de Sitter space on the other. And maybe you can reinterpret that as an up jump from nothing. But you should still subtract the action of nothing.
So suppose the action of nothing is nothing.
Yeah.
So then what would you prefer to jump to, the lowest de Sitter state or the highest one?
I don't. I don't know. I mean, my feeling would be the action of nothing should be infinite.
No.
this process shouldn't happen.
That is what the speaker in this audience think. But just say it was nothing. I'm just curious. The difference. So the way it goes is that you had said from a given positive vacuum you prefer to jump all the way to nothing. But what's the reverse statement? That is the action gets.
I'm just thinking because it's not immediately obvious when we plot these b's, we've subtracted off the action of de Sitter space. So you need to take these plots and add back. The action of de Sitter space. And I think at that point, you like to tunnel to, if this process happened, you would like to tunnel to the smallest positive cosmological constant solution, I think. I didn't want to be on the record.